Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando. The mission of the Reasonable Voice and the Reasonable Voices working together on our Blog Talk Radio shows is to connect the dots between politics and finance, need for a better education, humanity and world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world, and embracing creativity and political unity as solutions to all our challenges. Let me introduce our guest, a producer of the feature-length documentary 25 to Life, Leah Thomas. How are you, Leah?
I am great. Thank you so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. It's a tough subject. We don't want to give away too much. The premiere, by the way, of 25 to Life is going to be at the American Black Film Festival in New York City, my hometown, on June 22nd. And it was directed by an award-winning film director himself and a Spike Lee protege, Mike L. Brown. It's a story that follows the life of William Bronner of Philadelphia. Leah, welcome to The Reasonable Voice, and how did you get involved in this?
That's a great question. I met Mike Brown a few years ago at a symposium for people that were working, for young people that were emerging into the field that were working on documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
And he had started working on 25 to Life, and I was just riveted by the story. And I thought that there was something important and not well talked about
yes.
in the space that he was tapping into. And so I offered my help then, and I maintained offering my help throughout the year that we ended up working together. And so we're really excited to have the film come to fruition.
Yes. All right. I want to tell everyone that this is a movie. First of all, you may think you know what the title is, but you don't. 25 to Life is a fabulous title. If you can get the title right, you're halfway there. And this certainly speaks to what Leah's just saying to us. This is a subject that we never wanted to talk about. This was a major development discovered in the 1980s. Largely ignored even by the President of the United States. We were just going to ignore it to death. It wasn't real, especially if it only affected those people. We're talking, of course, about HIV/AIDS. But we're talking about it in 25 to Life in a way that personally I never even thought about. You want to enlighten us, Leah, how William Bronner's story is different from most?
Well, what I'll say the most about William Bronner's story and why I connected to it so deeply on two different levels. Bill found out that he had contracted HIV during the 80s, the early 80s.
Yes.
And I'm a child of the 80s. And if anybody can really remember that period of time, and I think, you know, now that it's 30 years later, lots of people are talking about what that really looked like at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But HIV/AIDS, when it came on the scene, it was hysteria.
Yes.
Well, people really were very unsure about how you could get it, why you got it. They likened things to certain behavioral statistics because they were trying to figure out how to categorize it. But what I'd like to say, and this is my own opinion, what they also were looking to do was find ways to make sure that that category didn't apply to them.
Exactly. Exactly.
And in the process of that, it ended up creating more sort of divisive dynamics than I think were ultimately necessary. So the part of William's story that I find just so rooted in the time period is that, for me, it likens it a lot to the Ryan White story.
Yes.
Where you have...
Yes, go ahead. I was going to say, tell us about Ryan White. Because I think we need to know, because I think that makes this all understandable.
I think so, too. I think so as well. I was younger when the Ryan White story broke. He was a young boy who lived in Indiana, and he contracted a hemophiliac, which means that his blood doesn't clot as others do when they're cut.
Yes.
So he went into the hospital often for blood transfusion. And as a result, he contracted the HIV virus, because at the time, obviously, we didn't know about the disease and there was a screening process. What he went on to do and become nationally, and I think even globally, is something that neither he nor his mother could foresee. But he ended up becoming a symbol for what this looked like for young people to navigate this space by themselves. We just want to live a normal life. So he had to petition the court in order to be allowed back into school,
yes.
To be allowed to, you know, attend his classes and receive his diploma. And he really became, I think, for our generation, or my generation specifically, a connection to understanding that this is something that's happening to everybody. This is something that we all need to be aware of. And if a young person can be treated like this,
yes.
Then imagine how we're going to be treating adults. And so that's really was a special time, I think, for me as a growing person, because it started my ability to really look at at people and citizens and the world as brothers and sisters. And, you know, for me, on an empathetic level, it allowed me to understand that we have to, while you think something doesn't affect you, take that sentence out. It's wrong. Everything affects you.
Yes.
And what are you going to do about it to be helpful?
You know, you bring up so many great points in that answer. I remember very well the case of the young child White and his other parents not wanting him back in the school not wanting him back. I remember that extremely well. And as you say, he was a child, and it's not, it didn't fit what the 80s meant. Admittedly, I'll give you this. Everyone was terrified. What was his thing? Okay, having said that, terror and fear of the unknown has driven a lot of us to do things we shouldn't do. But let's acknowledge that. It was terrifying. It was unknown. People were dying. All of a sudden, it seemed to appear out of nowhere, and we were looking for someone to blame. But it wasn't this kid, and most immediately, most Americans jumped right on. It was the homosexual society of our society. Whereas many people were given HIV, and again, we should make the distinction between HIV and AIDS, but we'll get into that more later. But given the HIV virus by blood transfusions, as this young man, and as your character, your lead character of Will Bronner. This was a situation where totally out of his control, both because of his age and the circumstances which led to the blood transfusion. All of this was out of his control, and that led to that and the coverage of Ryan, yes. That led to a family decision. How much can you talk about that without giving away too much?
It did. That time period is exactly when Linda Bronner, Will's mother, learned that Will had contracted the HIV virus,
yes.
Through a blood transfusion. He had a terrible accident at home and went to the hospital and needed a transfusion. And that's the time period, and everything that was going on led to the family conclusion and decision that they were going to keep it quiet.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to have Will go through the things that they saw that Ryan White went through.
Exactly. And that, of course, was a decision made for a young child, not by him. And he wasn't really informed of that decision for a bit, right? Was he adolescent or in elementary school when he was told?
When he was told.
Yes.
So, Will contracted the virus when he was under 2 years old.
Yes.
So there wasn't even, you know, the ability, the cognitive ability to explain to a child that young was going on.
And even when it was explained and the decision was told to him, you know, he was still a kid. His mother says, well, we're not going to talk about this. We're not telling anybody. This is a family secret. Well, what was he going to do, you know?
Right. Yeah, and I think that at the time, he didn't fully understand why he wasn't to talk about it.
Yes. Other,
outside of the fact that that was what the decision was that was made.
Yes.
So he, on his own terms, as he became an adult, as he became an adolescent, as he became, you know, a young man, and then as an adult, had to define for himself what that secret meant and when that secret became something that he didn't feel should be kept quiet anymore.
Exactly.
And that's what our film really tackles,
yes.
is his journey to want and his desire to want to live an open and honest future and life. And you know, we're just so grateful that he allowed us along for the ride.
I think the phrase he uses that really hit me, because it's, well, it's what most of us want. I was trying to be normal. I mean, how do we fault him that? I was trying to be normal. It is a film, it is a story, a character, if you will, a life that one can be judgmental if that's where you want to go. But I think you really owe it to yourself, not just the characters or even the makers of the film. You owe it to yourself as the audience, and by audience I mean humanity, learning of this, experiencing this, seeing this through the eyes of Will and his family, and all those that he knew in college and beyond. You need to look at it and walk in those shoes. And those are the shoes of the 1980s. Those are the shoes of the Reagan administration response to the disease. I can remember myself when we didn't know what was going on, so everyone was being extremely, I mean, you know, you heard so many different stories. We know it wasn't airborne, but it was body fluids and what, you know, everything. So it was not drinking after one another. And I remember a friend of mine who had AIDS, and he told me once that he had more to fear from me than I had to fear from him, because he had no resistance to my germs, whereas I did. So it's been here for a while. It seems that the medications are catching up. There are fewer cases being reported now, but it would be foolish to think that AIDS and HIV are not with us. It's like, what is it, 2.1 million people worldwide with HIV are adolescents between 10 and 19 years old. So it's still with us. Tell me, in this effort for his mother, Linda, not to allow Will to go through what Ryan White had to go through, and then with later on as he was growing up, I guess we can say now that 25 to life is, it is that much of this revelation of what I'm going to do, how can I balance, find the balance between my privacy and the right of other people to know, if I may put it that way, comes about when he's 25 years old. Is that accurate?
27. So it's 25 years that he had the virus.
Yes. So he's walking around proof that one can survive HIV, but for the most part, he can't tell anybody. What makes him decide to talk?
That's a great question. There were several factors, I think, that went into him deciding that this was the appropriate thing for him to do, something that he needed to do for himself, but then also for the people around him. He went to his doctor, and his doctor had highlighted that. So part of him going, living his life with HIV in secret was, or a byproduct of it rather, was him suppressing it mentally.
Uh-huh.
There was a disassociation with what it really meant to be HIV positive. And he decided when he embarked on his college phase to use the opportunity to reinvent himself.
Yes.
And to distance himself mentally from it. And so as a result, there were things and precautions that he should have taken that he did not take. And it was really great that you said that the film does open up a lot of questions in terms of judgment. But I think for us, it really does challenge the viewer. And I want to underscore that you pointed out so beautifully. It does challenge the viewer to really engage with the questions of the film, which is about choices and about responsibility and about accountability, but also being really honest and saying, who would you have been in this particular situation? And do you know, since it's something that you haven't been in? For him, what led him to opening up was, again, this disassociation. He did not take the proper precautions all the way through in terms of his medicine, in terms of several other choices. And a visit to his doctor reminded him, in very cold terms, you have to get on a very specific regimen. You have to really get back to owning that this is a part of your life.
And
if not, you have a very limited amount of time to live.
Yes, and it's real. I think when you are, especially from a young age, told by authority figures that this is a secret, and then you keep that secret because, after all, they are the people who know best for you. And then as you get older, as you said earlier, you are, of course, collecting your own life wisdom and beginning to evaluate things from a more adult position. You then must then accept the responsibility of your choices, because it isn't just an authority figure anymore, it's you. But my point I was going to make is that the longer we live a truth that we invent, and those are not always negative things. I think, frankly, I think Will's truth and his mother's truth for him probably helped in because mind over matter, you know, and the psychology of everything is, affects us physically. I think it may have helped him physically. But nonetheless, the longer we live a truth, the more it becomes the truth for us. And for his doctor to say, hold on a second, you know, day to day, I know you're feeling this way and you're feeling that way, and you think this is great, but here is a reality check. And when we come back, we're going to take a brief break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about how Will Bronner decided to respond to that reality check, because he made some very tough choices and followed through in a way that was a benefit to the larger community. That's all I'm going to say for right now. We'll be right back. We're talking with Leah Thomas. She is one of the producers of 25 to Life. It is a feature-length documentary. It is premiering at the American Black Film Festival in New York City on June 22nd, and I believe that's going to be at the SBA Theater, 333 West 23rd Street, for all my New York friends, and anyone who wants to zip into town and catch something really special. Stay with us. We'll be right back. To the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm here with my guest today, Leah Thomas, who is a producer of the feature-length documentary 25 to Life. The world premiere, again, is at the American Black Film Festival in New York City on June 22nd, 2014. We were about to, Leah, I was going to ask, once the doctor, Will's doctor, gave him the reality check, the cold water in the face, okay, you're living with this. You're living proof that it can happen. You are, that it's survivable. But there's still realities beyond your personal reality or personal truth. And that reality is there are medications, there's a regimen, there are health practices, there's social practices, and what does Will do with that? Now that he's been handed, at 2 years old, he was handed something he couldn't have even known about or been talked to about. Between 5 and 10, he finds out about it, but he still doesn't understand, okay, what is it exactly I'm keeping a secret? And now he's in his early 20s, he's out of college, and he's being hit with the doctor with another. So he gets handed these facts, these truths, these versions, and each time he's given one, he has to make an adjustment. And now he's gotten another. What does he do with what the doctor tells him?
Well, Will decides, and it's something that he's been planning in his mind for a very long time. And he had gone on the radio. He disclosed his status on the radio.
Uh-huh.
He had talked to, his mother about it beforehand. He had been on the radio before, but anonymously.
Yes.
Talking about HIV and AIDS, awareness, prevention, and tools of coping and living. He makes the decision to go on the radio and disclose publicly, using his name, that he is, in fact, HIV positive.
Yes.
That opens a floodgate of, across all borders that one can imagine, of questions, of
panic,
attack, of all of these other things. a panic, absolutely.
Yes.
And Will just, you know, has to confront that, answer those questions, seek redemption. He also had been planning in his mind for a very long time to start a youth center dedicated for teens living with HIV and AIDS diagnosis,
mm-hmm.
a place for them to therapeutically meet, talk, discuss, share information, and to find peer support, something that he found as a young person that he did not necessarily have.
Mm-hmm.
So he opened the Haven Youth Center.
Yes.
In Philadelphia, to meet that specific goal.
And he also offered them their privacy within the walls of the Haven Youth Center. The initial questions were primarily, how old are you and how long have you been positive? And then beyond that, what they wanted to discuss was what they discussed, but their privacy was respected and protected. And in a sense, he gave them the best of both worlds, which he did not always have. They could talk about it freely in that building if they chose to do so at the center and still maintain as normal a life of their own choosing on the outside. Is that accurate, more or less?
Absolutely. I think that what he provided with the group, with the peer group, was a place for people, for young people, to come and work through some of the things that were weighing on them in terms of day-to-day living. And I happen to believe that it's one of the most powerful segments of the film, because that is in the film, the first peer group that they have. And the biggest issue that comes up, and as I've been now working in the field as a result of the film and talking to different stakeholders in this space, the issue of disclosure is one of the number one topics that across the board, young people, old people, men,
yes.
women, and the ethnicity, the idea of this, you know, of being scared of that rejection from another human being,
yes.
Is something that is really, it is right up there with taking your medicine.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
doing all of the other things to keep you in a healthy mind frame is, how much can I share? When is the right time to share? And who am I safe with sharing? And so what I like to say about the film and about the topic itself is that as much weight as we put on people that have been diagnosed, as much, if not even more, weight should be put on people who have not, you know, had to live in that same circumstance, because we have to be cognizant of creating an atmosphere that allows for people to tell their truth and speak their truth and not have to fear so deeply the concept of being shunned or rejected as a result of living a full and open and honest life.
There are many medical issues where life conditions or life choices where if one is fully honest with friends and family, they are shunned. They are rejected. You know, whether it's a mental health issue or a sexual preference or, oh goodness, even these days can be a political preference, that we so shut down a person's faith that they can trust friends and families and the public with truth, with honesty, with full disclosure. And I'm not saying everyone should feel required to tell everybody everything, but if you have close relationships and you cannot fully say, this is who I am, and expect to still enjoy a certain amount of respect and appreciation and regard and love and affection, then yes, you close down. Who among us is willing to make that choice? You know, I'll speak the full truth and nothing but the truth, and then I'll be alone in the world. And I don't just mean lonely. I mean alone. I mean shut off like we used to treat lepers, for heaven's sake. What?
Absolutely.
You know, I remember going back to one of the lines again, and there's so many in the film, but one that his mother said, she would, as they lived the reality they had created for his safety, she too would get lost up because good things were happening. It was a good life, relatively speaking. He seemed certainly healthy enough as a child, and nice things were happening. And she would say, it would just catch her. She would realize, oh, if only he didn't have it. What a wow! You know, everything is so wonderful. If only he didn't have it. Because there it hangs. How is he helping others now, beyond the youth center?
I think that he has fully embraced his life as an HIV/AIDS activist. He has to run with World Campaign, and which signs people up to do the AIDS walk, and he helps to facilitate testing and awareness, and has just embraced his life from that standpoint of what his contribution can be to society, and how he can, from his background, which is somewhat distinct from, I think, how people typically, and again, we have to talk about stigma and prejudice, how people typically think about who the disease is affecting, or the virus rather is affecting. I think that he has the ability to come at it from a completely new and fresh perspective,
yeah,
and allow for conversations that, you know, in spaces where it isn't being talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't want to shy away from what his levels of responsibility were and accountability, and the fact that we all make choices, some of them good, some of them bad. He made some that were bad, but he's made a lot of good choices as a result,
yes,
of learning from that. And I think at the end of the day, all we can ask from each other, from the world, from society, is that as you get new information, you make better choices and decisions.
Yes.
And I think that that's what he has gone on to do. I know for one, through the course of making this film, have come to a place where I am more open and have, you know, made personal decisions to create an, you know, if I thought I had created a welcoming environment around me, I am now putting even more effort into making sure, yeah, that I've created a welcoming environment around me. And I hope that other people do the same. And he's definitely inspired me to do that. And
mm-hmm.
So that, I think, is something that we hope the film translates, and I think that can also be something that's listed under what he has done to make the world, or to make, you know, at least this issue and this situation better.
And he's gone on to make yet another very, to say it's a serious contribution, is putting it mildly, Parenthood. How is that possible? I know I've seen the film, but people must be wondering, oh my God, he's going to have children. But tell us about that. And this sperm washing.
Yes. So when we meet Will in the film, he is engaged to his fiance, who's HIV negative, and he is moving forward in life in terms of planning to get married and live a full family life, at the same time as dealing with sort of the uproar that his disclosure disclosed.
Yes.
And we go through the process of getting pregnant, which it was a wonderful, wonderful thing for him and Bridgette. It was difficult to go through. They did in vitro.
Mm-hmm.
And they can do that through a process called sperm washing, which is something I learned throughout the making, that the HIV virus can be separated from the sperm itself through a process called sperm washing.
Mm.
And then that sperm is used to in the in vitro process. And so that is how they were able to have their first child through that process. And it's a wonderful part of the film that we get to see that. I think, again, one of the things that Will is able to show in the film is that, and what we like to talk about, is that the film is not about dying of HIV or AIDS. It's about living with it.
Yes.
And he shows a very full life.
Yes.
And there are ways, thankfully, with technology and the time period and us moving forward and the advancement of medical research, that he's a full demonstration of the fact that an HIV diagnosis, what it was and considered in the 80s, is a completely different conversation and reality now.
Yes.
And so, yes, he does, in fact, go through the process of becoming a father.
Yes. And we get, and as you said, for me, it was one of the most moving scenes, as they, first of all, they allowed you to come in and film this, but that they went through this. And they, I mean, you know, talk about love. That, that's a powerful marriage there. That's some dedication and commitment, and gives a whole new level to, for better or worse, and all that. Let's shift just a little. Not that we won't come back to this, because it is the story of living and not of dying. It's the story of not giving up, but carrying on and helping others. As you learn how to deal with things yourself, you know, you're not born knowing everything or how to solve every problem or answer answer every question. You have to grow into it. People, you know, look at others and go, why didn't you do this? Why you? Well, you know, I was a kid, and now I'm no better, and I'm doing better, and there we go. But the actual shooting of this, again, it's certainly documentary style, and you're right in close on everything. How was that? How long did it take to shoot, and where? Were you in Philadelphia primarily, Howard University?
The process of filming, I believe Mike follows, Michael Brown is the director,
yes,
of the documentary, and he followed Will and his family for about 5 years.
Wow.
And we see that journey happen over time in the film, and that's why so much is able to happen in the film as well, mm-hmm, in terms of trajectory, in terms of when we meet him and what we get to see him do and accomplish and live through. Most of the filming took place in Philadelphia, where Will is.
Yes.
There's some traveling that happened both in the, I believe in Alabama and in Atlanta, where he goes to visit people, but the majority of it took place within his home state. There is some Howard footage. He does go back to visit Howard, and he was an alum, and Mike Brown, our director, is also an alum.
Uh-huh.
And so there is some stuff that was shot in the D.C. area, but the majority was in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. We're still, even though he has done quite a bit of radio now as himself with his real name and the whole story is out there and time has passed, is he still running into any relationships that are annoyed or challenging or resentful or still panicky? Is any of that still around?
You know, I'm not sure. I can't speak to that specifically per person.
Uh-huh.
But what I can say is that stigma is stigma.
Yes.
You know, and I think that, as you know, we have not come as far as we need to come as a community, as a culture. And so with that understanding, I think that there will always be prickly situations. I think there will always be a need for deeper questions. I think there will always be a need for someone else to express their opinions and thoughts about how this affected them, whether it was personally, indirectly, through osmosis. I think that those environments are always going to exist as long as we have not fixed the issue and the problem of stigma.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, before we go, tell us a little about your filmatic history. You have done things before this. This is not first time for you. Can you give us just a brief bio or some films that you've worked with that we might know about? Like,
sure.
Yeah.
I produced a series with TV One called Murder in Black and White, where it was a four-part documentary series where we looked at unsolved civil rights murders and put them in context. And that was an amazing experience to both go back in time, but then also to marry that to, you know, the way that society and culture had advanced or not advanced
as yes.
pertains to, you know, particular aspects of it. I also have been working on a documentary on the Gang of Four, which is centered on Congressman Charlie Rangel, former Mayor David Dinkins, Basil Patterson, who recently passed, and Percy Sutton, who also passed about 2 or 3 years ago. And I spent some time in Florida recently as a field producer on a documentary surrounding the Jordan Davis murder trial. Well, specifically the murder trial of Michael Dunn, who is the accused killer of Jordan Davis, which was another high-profile murder case, much similar to Trayvon Martin, that took place in Florida. I think a lot of people in the media called it the Loud Music trial. So I spent a few weeks down there covering that trial as well. So a few years now working in the documentary space, but usually in specifically on things that have a social justice end,
mm-hmm,
and have the ability for change, to bring about change and to inspire change. That's our focus. That's what I've, you know, kind of dedicated my time towards, and 25's life was something that I think morally fits within that wheelhouse
yes.
for me in terms of really sparking new conversations in spaces where people weren't talking.
Excellent and well put. Give us a website where we can get more information.
Absolutely. The website for the film is 25 to Life Film Site. website, SITE.com. There you can get a little bit of information about the film, about the filmmakers, and of course, purchase tickets for the premiere event, which will be, as you mentioned, June 22nd, mm-hmm. Which is a Sunday, here in New York City at the SBA Theater. And also additional facts about HIV and AIDS, you can look at our website, or you can go to the Kaiser Family Foundation. They also keep a very good up-to-date list of the current facts that are going on, not only just statewide, nationally, but also globally. In this space. But we would love to have people come out and see the film and really engage in the conversation. So thank you for allowing us the ability to even mention that.
Oh, I'm very thankful and glad to have been a part of letting people know about you, Leah, and 25 to Life. And my hat off to the 25 to Life director, Mike L. Brown, and to all of you on the team. I wish you all the very best. And thank you so much, producer Leah Thomas, for being on the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio today. All the best to you on June 22nd and the premiere.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having us.
Our pleasure. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us in becoming one of the reasonable voices heard around the world. God give me guts is a famous D-Day prayer. Dare conservatives and liberals together honor D-Day 1944 and 2014 in giving innocent until proven guilty another shot? Free will empowers us to emulate the greatest generation, or be sovereign citizens with an open-carry domestic terrorist agenda, to be defined by convenience store owners cheating Florida's lottery players, or be like Flight 33 passengers and heroically save potential gun violence victims from Seattle to Atlanta in a single day. But do we have the D-Day guts to defend the rights of Americans who continually demand our constitutional rights while they distort the sacred honor of the nation-defining words written therein? And do we have the D-Day guts to reach out to true conservatives who are being discriminated against by Koch-funded governors that they themselves elected? Have we D-Day guts to be Republicans that make Eisenhower and Reagan proud by liberally defeating governors who are anti-teacher, anti-voter, anti-citizen in Wisconsin, West Virginia, Oklahoma, Ohio, Nevada, Kansas, Iowa, Arizona, and anti-renewables, cokeheads, anti-middle America legislatures? However, before redefining ourselves as America, the gem of the Eddie Slovak firing squads dispatching deserters as traitors, which, by the way, was condoned by General George Washington in 1781 to deter potential Federal Hill mutineers, let's acknowledge in our Civil War, though both North and South executed deserters, they usually waited until after a court-martial. D-Day 1944, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and General Dwight D. Eisenhower sent 150,000 of the greatest Allied generation to take back Europe from the Nazis. And on D-Day 2014, we celebrate that for 70 years, the French, despite the insulting old Europe Rumsfeld and ugly American arrogance of Freedom Fries, have returned to the Normandy American Cemetery to tearfully thank America and Americans for coming to thank Lafayette. We can transform support our troops into a cliche of political convenience to cover up an appalling lack of medical treatment for veterans, or we can support the bipartisan Veterans Affairs Reform Bill by ejecting a Congress that has supremely failed both American civilians and those who've served them in the military. We can choose to love thy neighbor as thyself, or closet our neighbors in brown back-stained states in favor of lower taxes for the wealthiest while enabling legislatures to disable Medicaid expansion for the neediest, and, on top of that, force legislative conversion on gay Texans. We can honor what veterans have fought, suffered, and died for, the sanctity of one person, one vote. Or we can host 2 a.m. tea parties behind closed courthouse doors and, like Executive Republican Chair, use Hinds County Sheriff to ignore the fact that campaign staff were left alone with private ballots cast by Mississippi voters. We can choose to take lives or choose to save lives, to protect votes or steal elections. We can choose to do better in this 2014 election than imitating Watergate and Jim Crow with photo ID abuses of Justice for All. And we can put bank executives' backs against the firing wall with legal investigation, indictment, and trial by jury. We can continue the second American concentration camp where legal counsel, trial by jury, parole, and judicial sentencing is outlawed or risk being impeached for executing an end run around a do-nothing Congress of hypocrites to close a maleficent Guantanamo, a stain on America's fading reputation for human decency with conduct unbecoming. We can, as Lincoln's past, borrow and return habeas corpus, or we can be mushroom cloud gangbangers, stealing and preserving our habeas corpus for a growing police state. Yes, we can, like tornado-destroyed Greenburg, Kansas, rebuild with renewable wind towers, if only in 2014, as we did in Operation Overlord, we reignite our United States of we band of sisters and brothers, seize the torch of Lady Liberty, and muster the guts to outvote Citizens United, temper climate change, and bring all our people home. Join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.
Thank you for continuing to listen, support, and share the Reasonable Voice with your friends. We are now accepting offers for your company or organization to advertise with us, and welcome new sponsors for the Reasonable Voice. To apply, please email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com.
Thank you for joining us today and every day, and recommending us to all your friends, both online and offline. And please download our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.